The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Tonight I wanted to talk about patience. And I know that is not always everyone's favorite topic because we might associate it with being made to wait or to accept a situation under someone else's authority. In other words, there was some kind of a power situation and we didn't have the power and we were told to be patient. But what intrigued me about this topic, particularly recently, is that the Buddha talked about patience as one of the best counteractions to anger. And we often think of love, loving kindness, or metta as something that we would apply to work against anger or to balance out anger. And that is also true. But what about patience? It's very interesting to consider that quality. And as I reflected on it, I realized that patience has a lot of other mental qualities and dharma qualities wrapped up in it. And if we take patience as kind of the lens, it's going to bring in wisdom, compassion, mindfulness, all kinds of other good mental and heart qualities that we develop. So I wanted to offer that lens tonight as what would it be like to see patience as our approach to life, especially in these times that can be agitating, challenging. So I alluded to patience being something where we felt like we had to just endure. But I would say that actually patience is very powerful, true patience, because with true patience we're not swayed by the urge to act or to react. So we have the power because something else or someone else can't get the better of us, in a sense. That doesn't mean that all will go well, all will work out well, everything will come together as we wanted it. Life doesn't offer that. But patience as a quality of character is something that's really valuable to bring into this human life. So we'll talk about patience almost as an approach to life. Yeah. And one way to see that is to divide it into three different facets that I'll try to go through. They're not entirely separate. They're just different aspects of this much broader quality of patience. So the first might be called patient perseverance. And this is just as it sounds, it's the quality of just keep doing it or just keep showing up. I think we can understand this intuitively as meditators because it has very much to do with the meditation instructions where we sit and we have the intention to be with the breath or the body or some object. And of course, the mind doesn't quite do that. It goes off or the body is acting up something. And the instruction is just keep coming back. You know, if you spend the whole hour just coming back again and again 100 times, it was an hour well spent. You know, we've been told. But sometimes we have to learn that by chasing after all the gyrations of mind and body again and again out of desire to hold on to them or aversion and pushing them away, all that actually really just exhausts the mind. And in the end, what works is to just keep coming back. Just keep coming back to the breath, back to the body, back to the present moment. I think it's a normal pulsation, actually, distraction and reorientation, if you will. And that's what allows the mind to settle and the heart to open. And then out in the world, I think we can also understand this somewhat intuitively. There are many cases where it's going to take some time for something to unfold or to happen, and the only way it can come about is with some steady effort over time, like learning a craft or a skill, you know, learning a musical instrument or a sport or anything, really. And there's the understanding that we can't jump into being a professional right away. There's a process in allowing that to unfold. You do have to start with the basics, get a solid foundation, and then there's practice and practice and practice. And there's a lot of patient perseverance in this. And then there are other factors that get pulled in. You need wisdom or instruction to correct errors that you're making. And I think there's also a need for some courage in this, in going through a process like this. Sometimes there's courage just in staying with it if it seems like it's not going to get to the next stage. And sometimes there's courage in moving to the next stage when we've gotten comfortable at one of them. You know, we had achieved that first level of competency. And then it's kind of tempting to just kind of sit there and do that for a while. But, you know, with some courage, we can move on. The Buddha said that the path he describes unfolds by gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress. And he often gives kind of an agriculture analogy of growing a seed, you know, growing a plant from a seed and then eventually bearing fruit. It is inevitable that that will happen, but the conditions have to be nurtured. My father practices transcendental meditation, and he has done that for, I don't know, 45 or years or so. And he never really got into the check-ins and the retreats and doing all of that. He really just got his mantra and went with it. But I was reflecting that basically he just gets up and he sits every morning for 20 minutes doing the mantra that he was told. And he's been doing the same meditation instruction for 45 years. So this is a lot of patience. Some of us might not last that long. It hasn't always been the same experience. You know, his practice has unfolded. But he didn't get restless for other things. Now recently he discovered Vipassana practice where you're supposed to investigate and do all these different things. And he's very excited about that. But for the first 45 years, it was the same instruction. I think we could take a lesson from this, some of us who may not have had that much patience. Do you guys know what a durian fruit is? Yeah, some of you are nodding. There are these, there are these fruits from somewhere in Southeast Asia that are famous for their very pungent odor, and also for their somewhat difficult presentation. They have sort of knobs and spurs on the outside. They're not that friendly looking, even. And there's something called a porcupine fruit sometimes, I think they're called. Actually, this is a distraction, but I was looking up something about durian fruit, and I discovered that there was a doctor who actually wrote a medical paper about injuries that he had seen caused by durian fruit falling on people under trees. It's like, oh dear. So, but one of the things about the durian fruit, besides its amusingly pungent smell, is that it's interesting to watch people try to get it open. There were some videos I saw online of people trying to get a durian fruit open, and it turns out that it's very hard to just crack it open. You need a sort of a big knife to get in there, and it's kind of a, you know, you open it and then you have to kind of pry it open to get it. But this is for a fruit that's kind of at its not quite ripe or generally ripe stage. It turns out that if you just wait and you put the durian fruit on your counter, and your neighbors are okay with that, if you if you wait, and when it becomes really ripe, it actually spontaneously starts to crack, and the shell will just open, and one day you'll come home and it's totally available to you, and your house smells like durian fruit. So there may be other problems with that. But when I read about this, I thought this is such a perfect illustration of the way we're always trying to grab stuff and pull it open and get the knife out and how can I, you know. But sometimes if we just wait, then there's this spontaneous softening, opening through the patience to just wait for that to happen. This is quite opposed to how we often think about things in mainstream culture, how we're encouraged to. Now we have Amazon same-day delivery, right? Instant gratification or instant feedback through social media. You know, you post something on Instagram, and if you don't get a certain number of likes or responses or whatever it is within an hour, you think, oh, wasn't it good? So we think that things are more valuable if they happen immediately. It's actually been shown that web pages that load a fraction of a second longer than other web pages will get less traffic, fraction of a second. But there are things that really can't be sped up or can't be sped up very much. Physical healing, for example. You can do some things, of course. Or agriculture. There's no Moore's Law for medicine. It doesn't get twice as efficient every 18 months or whatever it is. So it's kind of a delusion that faster is better or that patience is a weakness. And then another thing that can't always be sped up is the spiritual path, right? It ripens in a certain way. And so this patient perseverance is really an act of compassion and tenderness and wisdom toward our own unfolding. The Buddha says that the fetters that bind the mind are something like the ropes on a ship that has been pulled out of the water and let sit through a stormy season, and the salt and the sun and the rain and batters these ropes, and then they just fall apart. You know, when you get the boat out in the spring, you have to replace all the ropes because they just fall away. And in the same way, the fetters that are binding our mind or our heart, somehow over time, through the enduring the sunlight of attention and maybe the tears also, somehow soften them, and then at some point they fall away. So patience is something like non-contention with these. It's very much related to non-contention with the things that we encounter on our path. So this is patience as patient perseverance. And then the non-contention is a sort of a transition to the second aspect or the second kind of patience, which is sometimes said as patience under insult, which I appreciate that phrase. So this is about receiving well the energies that come at us, yeah, whether they're especially hostile or negative energy, which we will encounter here in the world. There's going to be stuff that's, you know, challenging for the mind or disruptive to the system. We're going to come in contact with things like that. That's part of the First Noble Truth. And the question is how to be patient. What does it look like to have patience under insult? A really valuable way I've seen to consider this is to understand that we're protecting something of value. By having patience under insult, we're protecting something of value. So our peace, our ease, our equanimity, these are precious, precious qualities in our life and in our heart. Why would we give them up? Especially for something that's coming at us that isn't that positive. Why would we give those up? If someone is angry with us or is not showing restraint or care, I wouldn't throw away my peace for that. Of course, the mind reacts sometimes and does anyway, but it really helped me to understand, oh, this is something that's worth protecting. And so then patience is the quality that we'll put forth when we're protecting something good within us. The Buddha did not always encounter pleasant people and situations. So I'm sorry to say that enlightenment is not going to save you from angry people and insult. Somebody came once to the Buddha, there's a story recorded, where they came and they hurled a bunch of insults at him and questioned things that he had said. And he said, okay, just wait a minute, let me ask you something. And he said, this was a wealthy person who was part of high society at the time. And he said, do you ever have people come over to your house, come and visit you? And he said, well, yes. And when they come, do they sometimes bring gifts or food? And the person said, well, yes. And then the Buddha said, well, if you were to not accept those gifts that they brought, what would happen to them? Who would they belong to? And he would say, well, they would remain with the person who brought them. And the Buddha says, just so, I do not accept your insults. So, this is patience under insult. Yeah. And so in this way that we're talking about it, this is very much about restraint, because the strong habit of the mind is to retaliate and to return anger with anger. Or it may not even be anger. I mean, it applies also to situations that are harmful, like being in a group that's gossiping about somebody, and everybody's gossiping away, and that's how you're going to be socially accepted, is if you join in. So do you just jump in and participate? Or do you recognize that that is somehow a giving up of something valuable? You know, it's a lowering of something precious that is within you. So we don't want to participate in the insulting of others. So the point is essentially to ride things out, you know, to develop a capacity of heart or of awareness that allows us not to get drawn into negative energy or things that are harmful, and then just kind of wait until the source ends on its own, because it will. It's there because of conditions, and eventually those conditions must fall apart, and the anger of the other person will end, the situation will change, something. And so if we can just avoid being drawn in, this can be the best approach. You know, not that we ignore them uncompassionately or say, I'm protecting something much more valuable here. That's not going to be a good approach. But somehow finding a path through that where we're not getting drawn in. But I'd say that's about half of patience under insult. And it's the first half, maybe the one that we need to cultivate if we're prone to getting sucked in. But I don't think it's implying that passivity is the only response to things that are challenging. There's also, I think, a more active aspect to patience under insult. And this could be something like the ability to deliberately choose a different path and stick with it. So the patience is the ability to stick with something that's different than what's happening. So not only to not retaliate or not participate in the insult, but to meet that unskillful energy with something more skillful and have the strength to stay with that. This is very much the principle behind, say, nonviolent resistance, you know, of what Martin Luther King was doing, for example. So they would go and sit at lunch counters and just not move. There was nothing unpeaceful about this, but it wasn't passive acceptance, certainly. And for sure, you know, they were deliberately going where they were told not to go, and then they had to show patience under insult, for what happened while they were sitting there. And this is also where the connection to maybe the more common response to hatred that you've heard fits in. Hatred never ended through hatred. Through non-hatred alone does it end, or through love alone does it end. So choosing a different path, so hatred ends when we choose something different and are able to stick with that. Gandhi said, first they ignore you, Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win. So there's a certain element here, right, of bearing with, staying with, but, you know, choosing a different path and just staying with that. So these examples begin to show why the Buddha said that patience is what counteracts anger. It's habitual to return anger with anger. But if we don't do that, then we're displaying the patience. And if we have that at the beginning, initially, so we don't react, then there's the possibility of choosing love or generosity or compassion, something else. But the patience is what prevents the reaction. You could see it that way. I guess I've given some somewhat dramatic examples, but I'm reminded that this morning at about 5 a.m., the fire alarm on the outside of the building where I live went off. And it happens that that fire alarm is mounted on the wall. You know, it's one of those outside ones. It looks like those old-style school bells that ring, right? And my bed is on the other side of the wall, right where that is. And for sure, I woke up when that turned on. I feel like I have something with fire alarms because there were a lot of fire alarms when I lived at IRC also. But I noticed my mind. I mean, I noticed what happened. Of course, I had to do something about that. You know, I got up and I tried to figure out what is that. I'd never heard one of those outside fire alarms go off. I went out and figured out what it was. But I know I was watching my mind because it was certainly irritated with the sound. 5 a.m. wasn't too bad. It's better than 2 or 3 a.m. But I thought about, well, how can I turn that off? It turns out there's a breaker for it. But the breaker is the same breaker that controls the refrigerator. So I didn't really want that to be off for a long time. So I did end up calling the fire department to have them take a look at the system. It seemed like there might be something wrong with it. And then I noticed that they parked the fire truck outside on the right on my street where all these other people live, and the fire truck was idling and it had the lights going for half an hour while they messed around with trying to figure out how to turn this off. So I hope my neighbors also had patience under insult. So that's a little bit of a distraction. But still, my sense was I never really felt upset about it. I mean, I felt it's unpleasant and I need to do something and I can't not do something about this. But when I looked back over my mind, I noticed that there wasn't a tendency to blame somebody. I had a good time joking around and talking with the firefighters. This is Santa Cruz we're talking about. So when I said my bed is right on the other side of that wall, right behind that bell, the guy said, "That is awesome." It was great. So, you know, there was something was coming forth that I attribute as a fruit of practice. So the third aspect of patient acceptance of the truth, sometimes how it's said. And what this means is developing the ability to be with the way things are. And we are not always, first of all, not always aware of the way things are. That's part of what we practice to be able to see. But it's also not that comfortable. There's a reason why we've been choosing ignorance, is that we, it's the truths of the world are sometimes hard to be with. We have to develop some capacity. So learning the patterns of human life, learning how things actually are, despite how we want them to be. You know, we come to practice with a lot of false ideas about things, as well as some good ideas. And we gradually learn to discern the false ones through an accumulation of facts gained through mindfulness. And so some of these truths, that, you know, patience, acceptance of the truth, One is that we may begin to notice, after many, many times, that propping up our ego is not really worth it. We have a strong tendency to want to look a certain way, be a certain way, maintain a certain kind of image, and it's actually really hard to manage our self-image because it's not entirely under our control. Other people have opinions that they arrive at without asking us about that. And so it's exhausting to really try to be a certain kind of self in the world and maintain that at all times. And it can take a long time, though. We can really say, but no, I have to be this way. I have to not be this way. And this can take the mind a long time to patiently accept, no, it's actually never really satisfying to prop that up and create that and defend that. But it takes a while. And we learn that selfishness is not very satisfying in the long run. Behavior that is designed only to benefit me is not ultimately satisfying. And, you know, we may not be blatant about that, but there are ways in which we're angling for that. And eventually we learn that we can tune into the more subtle pleasures of generosity and compassion and other types of service, and that's actually more satisfying. But we don't always start with that. And another domain of kind of the truth about the way things are that takes us a while to accept sometimes is the changing nature of our experience, which basically boils down to I will lose things that I care about and things will come that I didn't want. This is the truth. It's not that we shouldn't try to, you know, have an easeful situation. It's not that we shouldn't choose to eat food that works for our digestive system, try to find a place to live that's quiet and has good neighbors. Of course, we do those things. But if our only quest in life is to get as much pleasant as possible and push away as much unpleasant as possible, this also is very exhausting and fruitless in the end. We can't make that happen. And if we can, even for like a moment, we get that really to be true, it changes. And we can't maintain that over the long period. But it takes a long time for the mind to learn that what we're going for is, you know, situations where we can maintain awareness and situations where we can offer service and other things that are supportive of the path of practice, which includes some degree of ease, some degree of peace, good relationships. Those are all included in things that support our heart and our mind. But if those are the only aim, it becomes unsatisfying. And then so I'm going through actually what are called the three characteristics of experience. So the first was the non-self kind of quality, and then the second was the impermanence. And I've saved dukkha, or suffering or unsatisfactoriness, for the last. And that's because maybe patient acceptance of the truth that there's a lot of suffering may be a little passive sounding. So then I'm going to bring in a word I said earlier, non-contention or non-resistance to the difficulties that inevitably are going to arise. So at least not getting angry and fearful about the fact that there is suffering and stress and struggle in the world. And we can't make it better for everyone else all the time. There's still going to be things that happen. I volunteer as a spiritual caregiver at Valley Medical Center in San Jose. And recently I have joined, I was asked to join a thing called the prayer team, which was put together by the chaplains, who are from religions that do more prayer than we do in Buddhism. And I was a little reluctant. I wasn't exactly sure how this was going to work, but something in me said, well, let's give it a try and see what the prayer team is. It's actually something that they ask people to do when they aren't able to come in very often. Like some people volunteer for the while and then they move away, like even to other cities and states. And so then they can be on the prayer team and still feel connected. And so now that I live in Santa Cruz, I don't get there as often. So the way this works is that the hospital has a prayer box and people can put in prayer requests on a little slip of paper. And then we get an email every week where they've written in what all the prayer requests that were received are. So I'm learning experientially what is the value of this kind of practice. So I thought I'd read a few samples from a recent week, just a few prayer requests. For recovery for two children burned in a fire and suffering from smoke inhalation. For a woman who was moved from full-time to part-time work and is having trouble making ends meet. For a son who is attending the death of his mother and unable to locate his brother to tell him the news. For a man suffering from psychiatric disturbances who is finding it hard to cooperate with his doctors and nurses. I get an email every week with these, and the instruction is to somehow fold them in to, if I do prayer, I would do that. I tend to, you know, hold in my mind that this is happening. So this is reality. This is the world. It will never be true here on the human plane that things like this are not happening, even if they're not happening in a certain life at a certain time. So being in this prayer group, I've discovered, is first and foremost about connecting with dukkha, you know, really being in with that. So I suppose prayer is a reasonable response to dukkha in some sense. And for me, I'm not praying to a god for something to happen, but I do sit with each of these requests and I take it in and I wish well for that person, and I understand that they are in this situation right now. And I hadn't thought of this sort of consciously as being a way of developing patient acceptance of the truth of suffering, but as I was thinking about this talk, it was obvious. It's like, oh, yes. So exposure to suffering can increase compassion. And it also increases patience and the capacity of the heart to accept the truth. And as we do this practice of patience, of seeing, so I've offered patience as a lens through which we can see an approach to life that brings in wisdom, compassion, mindfulness, care, generosity, all these things get pulled in when we think of how can I be patient with what's unfolding in my experience. Then patience can become kind of a way of being for us. It kind of gets so folded into our character that it's just how we are. And then it kind of undoes itself and is no longer needed. And for this, I think of an exchange that I witnessed. And there was a young nun who had just ordained, and she was still kind of learning how to get all the different pieces of her robe on, folded neatly. And she was with the senior nun who had ordained her. So the two of them were there. I think we were going out for a walk, maybe, and so she was putting on her outer robe, something like that. And she was struggling with it a little bit. I mean, not so much that the senior nun had to help her, but she was just, you know, trying to get it even, and it was taking a little longer. And she looked up at one point and said to the senior nun, you're being very patient with me. And the senior nun said, no. And at first I thought, huh, that's kind of odd. What does she mean by that? But it was clear from the situation that what she meant was She had absolutely no need for patience because she was not feeling impatient. She was not feeling irritated at all by watching this younger nun struggle a little bit to get her robe on. I mean, it doesn't look that easy to get those robes on to me. And so she wasn't feeling patience because there wasn't any need for it to arise. So it becomes just a description of how one lives. So these are my thoughts for tonight on patience. And we have a few more minutes if anyone has any questions or comments. I would love to know your thoughts on this. Yeah, wait for the microphone. Oh.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was going to say,
okay.
I was reading this book called Beginning Our Day with some reflections. And one I read about a week ago was equating patience with a form of metta for oneself. And so I've been hanging out with that idea that when I'm patient, it's not enduring something, but it's actually an act of kindness towards myself by holding things that way.
That's a lovely way to think about it. And I love that patience and metta are tied because those are the two things that are most in relationship with anger, right? Or resistance. Beautiful. Thank you. I think there was one here.
There's probably a patience metaphor in this, but I wanted to relay one of the mysteries of the durian fruit, which is that if you've never eaten one, it obviously smells like rotten eggs, and it actually tastes like onion soup. But it turns out that there's something very interesting about the durian. Some people love it. Well, it turns out the reason they love it is that you actually have to eat some, maybe once or twice, maybe three times, and then something changes and shifts. And the next time you encounter the fruit, it has an incredibly fragrant smell.
Oh, interesting.
And it tastes incredibly delicious.
Have you experienced this?
I experienced this. It took me about three times, and I tried this on somebody else, and the same thing happened to them. They had to eat almost a quarter of the fruit the first time around, and then a few days later, it was like magic. So maybe it's kind of like meditation. You just don't know what's going to happen. You just
sit
and something happens, right?
That's fantastic. Thank you.
I just had to share it.
Yeah.
You spoke about the fetters falling away. Was that under patience, under insult?
I think that was when it came up.
I think for me, the insult is the fetter. You know, I want to react to the insult. And I get tied to that. And like the ropes on the ship that decay, they fall away. It reminds me of the idea of renunciation not being a losing, but an opening into something greater. And when I have sometimes been able to experience the fetters falling away, it's as if I enter into a joy of this is how joyful the situation is as well. However, it has changed. It's no longer me just aware of those ropes of the ship holding me down. I'm now aware of the freedom I'm expanding into, and that has a sense of joy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.